Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, also on Monday's show, as we continue with our series on the feature-length documentaries nominated for an Oscar this year, we're going to have the filmmaker of the RBG documentary. So that ought to be really interesting on Monday. But as for right now, President Trump is expected to announce any minute a national state of emergency to help him build the border wall. We will get pre-action now and talk about some other things too, time permitting, with Congressman Hakeem Jeffries representing parts of South and Central Brooklyn and a wee bit of Queens. Hi, Congressman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Great to be on.
So let's assume for the moment that he does announce a state of emergency and does sign the budget bill. What would your reaction to that be?
Well, it would be another unfortunate abdication of his responsibility in terms of trying to encroach upon the clearly established power of the purse that is vested in the Article I Congress. Clearly, the president is grasping for straws and desperate to try to fulfill a campaign applause line by potentially declaring a national emergency and misappropriating money allocated by Congress for other important issues, including the possibility of misappropriating disaster aid in order to try and erect and construct his medieval border wall so he can satisfy his conservative critics on the hard right.
What options does the House have, if he does it, the House in particular, since you're a member of the House, for a legal challenge or other response?
Well, we have an opportunity to possibly consider a resolution of disapproval that, of course, would pass the House, but would have to overcome potential Republican opposition in the Senate, since they have often conducted themselves like a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump administration, led by Mitch McConnell. We'll see what happens in that regard. We also are exploring the opportunity of a legal challenge that could be brought potentially by the House of Representatives. There is precedent showing when funds are potentially misappropriated that are not based on a congressional allocation, that there is an opportunity to establish legal standing to bring a lawsuit. It's also possible that some potential property owners who could have their property adversely impacted along the southern border would have standing to bring a lawsuit as well. And I know there would be significant backing for them if they chose to do so.
Did you vote for this budget agreement to avoid another shutdown? Many of your New York City House colleagues did not.
I did support the agreement, both because we indicated from a very early stage that when the reckless government shutdown was over, we were prepared to have a mature conversation about border security and to try to find common ground in a bipartisan fashion that would be anchored in investments such as increased infrastructure around our legal ports of entry. We were able to accomplish that objective, hiring additional immigration judges so that we could process the migrants who were seeking asylum in our country. We were able to accomplish that objective. We were able to add increased humanitarian aid so that the conditions along the southern border in terms of medicine, food, shelter, clothing, transportation were improved so that people could exist with the dignity and respect that they deserve. We accomplished that objective. And we also invested additional funds in terms of technology in an evidence-based fashion. So with respect to the Homeland Security portion of the spending agreement, on balance, I think it was a step forward anchored in a 21st century border security approach. And then there were a whole bunch of other areas where we were able to make substantial progress, an additional $1 billion in funding to make sure that there's an accurate census count, incredibly important for New York, an additional $500+ million for the Section 8 affordable housing voucher program, incredibly important in New York and other gentrifying places across the country. We were able to increase and authorize a pay raise for federal workers of 1.9%. That was a House Democratic priority. As you may recall, Brian, the president indicated a month or two ago he was going to freeze federal worker pay. That's outrageous. And we were able to include that in the agreement. So on balance, I thought that it was a significant step forward, and that's why I supported it.
And just for the record, since this is new and many of our listeners wouldn't have heard this before after the vote, which took place just last night, roll call reports a total of 15 Progressive Caucus members voted against the measure. 7 of the 15 were freshmen, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from here in New York. She and 3 others issued a joint statement saying they opposed the package because, quote, the Department of Homeland Security does not deserve an increase in funding, unquote. And other no votes came from Yvette Clark and Adriano Espaillat and Nydia Velasquez from the city. Velasquez said she voted against the bill because it didn't include disaster aid for Puerto Rico, while Clark and Espaillat cited inaction on DACA and TPS immigrants, all that from roll call. So those are most of your closest colleagues. Why are you on a different page?
Well, you know, Jerry Nadler, a strong progressive, supported the agreement. Barbara Lee, a strong progressive, supported the agreement, perhaps the most liberal member of the United States Congress. She was on the conference committee that negotiated the spending bill, as well as some of my allies and friends within the New York delegation, such as Gregory Meeks and Grace Meng as well. And so there will be times when we agree to disagree about the approach forward. My willingness to support this agreement, in part related to the fact that the most significant issue confronting the neighborhoods that I represent is the intense socioeconomic gentrification that is sweeping through central Brooklyn, the neighborhoods of Bedford-Stuyvesant, Fort Greene, Clinton Hill, and increasingly at risk of moving into places like Ocean Hill, Brownsville, East New York, and the West End, the Coney Island. These are all neighborhoods that I represent. And to me, getting something done, particularly in the area of affordable housing, was essential, in addition to the other issues and many other items that Nita Lowy, the chair of the Appropriations Committee, was able to successfully negotiate.
The Times reported this week on the AOC and Justice Democrats wing getting ready to primary some entrenched, mostly older, white, and maybe not progressive enough New York Democrats who represent diverse districts, like Elliot Engel was mentioned by name in this article, Tom Suozzi, even Jerry Nadler, who chairs the Judiciary Committee that you're also on. The Times says a huge X factor in any Nadler primary would be the billionaire activist Tom Steyer, who has pushed for the impeachment of Trump. It says Steyer has already polled the popularity of impeachment in the district and is launching a $200,000 direct mail, television, and digital ad campaign this week, urging Nadler to begin impeachment hearings in his committee. So do you, as a member of that committee, agree it's time to start impeachment hearings?
Not at all. We need to allow Bob Mueller to complete his investigation, as the events of a few days ago have indicated. He is engaging in a thorough investigation. The allies of President Trump are playing checkers. Bob Mueller is playing three-dimensional chess and continues to build the case that there was serious wrongdoing that occurred. Just look at the Paul Manafort situation. We know that he's a liar. Bob Mueller has established that. We know that he's a crook. Bob Mueller has established that. The only open question right now is whether he was a Russian asset, part of a triangular relationship along with WikiLeaks, and Russian spies to sell out our democracy and artificially place Donald Trump at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The events of this week show that Bob Mueller is getting closer to potentially establishing serious collusion and conspiracy. We need to allow Bob Mueller to be Bob Mueller, complete his work, and then the House Judiciary Committee, the House Democratic Caucus, can decide what's the appropriate next step.
And last Friday, you were very tough in the hearing with Acting Attorney General Whitaker. But now Whitaker is gone as the new permanent attorney general. William Barr was confirmed this week by the Senate. I'm curious if you think anything lingers from the questions that Whitaker refused to answer last week that you feel the Judiciary Committee needs to follow up on, or is it all moot with him now gone?
Well, we need to make sure that during the 3-month unremarkable tenure of the former acting attorney general Whitaker, there was nothing that was done to undermine, limit, or constrict the ability of Bob Mueller to do his work. He indicated during his testimony, Mr. Whitaker, that there was limited communication between him and the White House and no communication in trying to obstruct the Mueller investigation. we're reviewing the transcripts and other evidence to see whether that, in fact, was an accurate statement or not.
My guest is Congressman Hakeem Jeffries of Brooklyn and Queens, a member of the top leadership of the House Democrats in this term. And we can take a few phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And as some calls are coming in, what's your reaction to the Amazon decision? You know, that issue split the Democratic Party pretty badly, as we were just talking about with the mayor. Where were you before the cancellation, and where are you today?
Well, prior to the cancellation, I had expressed optimism that this agreement would improve the economic well-being of people in and around those neighborhoods that I don't represent in Congress, but that I recognize the need for the community and for organized labor and for other stakeholders to try to negotiate an improved upon agreement from the one that was originally presented. There's a real deep-seated suspicion that makes sense in communities all across New York City when a big development deal is proposed. Initially, you're promised a field of dreams. What often turns out is there's a graveyard of broken promises. And so I viewed the announcement as a starting point, and it appears that Amazon was unwilling to negotiate improved upon things that would have really benefited the community and allayed some of the fears.
Affordable housing was such a big issue for the Amazon opponents, and it's always been a big issue for you, and you were in the state legislature. You were just referencing it as maybe the biggest problem in your district with respect to something that was in the federal budget. Can you tackle affordable housing from Congress, or is it really up to local politics?
Well, it's my view that we need an all-hands-on-deck approach at the city, the state, and the federal level. Certainly the state this year will play a significant role in strengthening our rent regulation laws, and I'm hopeful that they will enact the strongest tenant protection laws in the history of New York State. We need to repeal vacancy decontrol. We need to reform the preferential rent law. We need to severely limit the ability of landlords like the Trump Real Estate Organization from artificially jacking up rents by using and claiming so-called major capital improvements. So the state is going to play an important role this year, and I know there'll be tremendous leadership from Carl Hastie and Andrea Stewart-Cousins and, of course, Governor Andrew Cuomo. But beyond that, the federal government has to get back into the business of supporting affordable housing. We've begun that process over the last two budget agreements. We need to continue that. If there's any infrastructure plan, House Democrats have said $70 billion must be set aside to modernize and repair our crumbling public housing developments that have been neglected by the federal government for decades.
Here's an affordable housing question from Bobby in Flushing. Bobby, you're on WNYC with Congressman Jeffries. Hi.
Hi. I live in Flushing here, and we've been undergoing gentrification by the name of Treetop Development by Adam Mermelstein. A construction going on for 3 years nonstop. We're breathing in dust and all of this. But this is something the congressperson could do. Affordable rent is based on the AMI, area medium income. If you could get that change, just like how Anita Lowy, she got that change upstate New York that is not linked to, our district is not linked to New York City anymore. And the person in Westchester County did the same thing. That congressperson did the same thing for Putnam County as well. Why can't we have 12 people from New York City that serves in Congress, and not one of them can say, okay, let's de-link New York City from upstate New York so the rents could go down based on area medium income?
Right. That, and let me just explain the issue a little bit more to our listeners who don't know what area median income or MI means in this respect. When affordable housing rents are set in city projects and other things, it tends to be pegged to AMI, average median income. But is it the median income for, say, Bushwick, which would be a lot lower than, say, the median income for the entire New York City metro area? And as you know, Congressman, that's the heart of his question.
That's correct. And it's a very important question. And I believe that the overwhelming majority of the New York City delegation supports an adjustment to the manner in which the area median income is calculated. I certainly do, and it's something that we're going to fight for as we move forward now that we are in the majority. It's always been my view that as opposed to the area median income being based on several affluent communities within New York City so that the AMI for Brownsville and for East New York and for Bedford-Stuyvesant and for the West End of Coney Island is in part calculated based on median income on the Upper East Side of Manhattan or Chelsea or Soho or the suburbs of Connecticut and Westchester County. That makes no sense, that we should actually look at a more micro-targeted area median income based on either zip code, that would be at the most micro level, or certainly community board that I think would more accurately capture the median income for a given area, which is the basis, as you know, Brian, for determining how affordable housing prices are calculated.
Dina in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Congressman Hakeem Jeffries. Hi.
Oh, hi, good morning. Congressman Jeffries, thank you so much for the way you stood up to Matthew Whitaker. He was obnoxious. He was horrible. And he's a bully. And he represents what the other side is about. And you were terrific. You were the only one who really called him out and spoke to him and told him to hands off on the Mueller report. And thank you so much for finally someone who represents the American people to stand up to this bullying. We can't take it anymore. It's horrible. So thank you a million times. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And certainly we've made clear as a Democratic caucus that we have a constitutional responsibility to serve as a check and balance on an out-of-control executive branch. We don't work for Donald Trump. We work for the American people. And we are a separate and co-equal branch of government, and we're going to conduct ourselves in that fashion. And there's a new sheriff in town. Her name is Nancy Pelosi. She's got a crew riding behind her in the House Democratic Caucus, and we're going to make sure that we stand up for the American people.
Nick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Congressman Jeffries. I think this is going to be a follow-up, but with a different result. Nick, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering why you think that, Mr. Jeffries, why you think that that we need to wait for Bob Mueller's investigation before we can start impeachment proceedings, because I feel like the investigation can continue long after he's impeached and possibly even when he's in jail. But because I don't know how long this investigation is going to last, and he needs to do a really thorough job.
Do you have grounds, Nick? What are your grounds as of today?
Grounds for impeachment?
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. It's hard to know where to start. I would say that you can start with...
well, that's why it's hard. But Congressman, the question from Nick and others, and as you know, others are putting it out there as well, not just Tom Steyer, that it's time to start an impeachment inquiry, right? You don't have to bring articles of impeachment before Mueller gives you the final piece of what may or may not warrant a vote. But there's so much there. There's been so much misbehavior at so many deep levels that it's time to start it is really where I think Nick is going.
Well, Chairman Nadler has taken the position, and I think this is appropriate, that before we pursue anything relative to the ultimate political death penalty, which is impeachment, one, we have to make sure that there's bipartisan support in order to go through with it. Two, of course, we should wait for the Mueller investigation to conclude because that would be the heart of any impeachment inquiry, whether there really was a conspiracy between the Trump campaign, Russian spies, and a triangular relationship that included WikiLeaks in order to sell out our democracy in order to elect Donald Trump. But simultaneously, we do have the opportunity to continue our oversight responsibilities where we can begin to reveal a whole host of facts to the American people simultaneous to the Mueller investigation. But the House Democratic Caucus is going to primarily focus on our For the People agenda. We're going to stand up for working families, middle-class folks, senior citizens, the poor, the sick, the afflicted, and veterans, as opposed to what we've seen from the other side, which is standing up for the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected. And we're going to do that by focusing on driving down the cost of health care, in particular, focusing on people with pre-existing conditions and working to lower the high cost of prescription drugs. We're going to focus on a real infrastructure plan, and we're going to focus on cleaning up corruption by bringing our democracy to life and giving the American people their voice back.
So we have 10 minutes left in the segment. At that time, 11 o'clock, you'll have to go and we'll have to go. The president is only now starting to talk about the wall and the budget, and we'll see if he declares a state of emergency. We're not going to go to it live. We're going to try to pull a clip of the salient part, which hopefully we can get in before we're done with you. But as kind of, you know, a pre-action on the assumption that he's going to declare a state of emergency, maybe this is not the worst thing in the world. Like, this is not the Muslim ban. This is not child separation or ICE acting as a deportation force. It's just fortifying the border. And the Pentagon budget this year, from which he would draw apparently, is more than, as you know, $600 billion. So if the president is just using this as a mechanism to redirect $8 billion or so of that to a border wall, maybe that's a small deal, and the same reason Democrats have supported barriers in the past. If Republicans can declare the border secure, then you have more political cover for comprehensive immigration reform in the future, and then you move toward that. I'm not saying this is my opinion. I'm saying that's a scenario that some people put out. What do you think of that whole way of looking at it?
Well, with respect to the mechanism that he will use, it's important that Congress is able to maintain its prerogatives with the constitutional power of the purse. And so regardless of the amount, even though billions of dollars to the people that I represent in the district where the median income is a little bit south of $40,000 is a whole lot of money and can be used to improve their quality of life in several different ways, the real heart of the issue is whether this individual, who is had autocratic tendencies sitting at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, is engaging in behavior inconsistent with the Constitution. That's not really the Hakeem Jeffries observation. James Madison himself wanted to make sure that we limited the ability of a president of the executive to start acting like a king. And that's why if he declares this national emergency in a manner that we think is inappropriate, you're likely going to see litigation, and then the Article III federal court system will have to work it out.
While we're waiting, and now he's saying, I'm going to sign a national emergency. It's been signed many times before. Did you know that apparently a few dozen of these things are in effect currently?
Yes, and this is all consistent with a law that was passed in the 1970s. I think we're going to have to reevaluate not just relative to Donald Trump's action that he's taking today, but relative to striking the right balance between the Congress and the executive moving forward, that the law may need to be reevaluated in terms of whether it is too loosely drawn to give the president enormous power to make such a declaration. But if you look at the specific four corners of the so-called border crisis, If there was a national emergency, did it just emerge today? Did it emerge yesterday? Did it emerge this week? Apparently, the president has not seen fit to declare a national emergency during the entire 2 years plus of his presidency. And to the extent there's a national emergency, I can give him a few other suggestions. The gun violence epidemic is a national emergency. Tens of thousands of people every year die as a result of gun violence, either homicides or suicides. Seems to me that there should be some action taken. Thankfully, the House Democrats just passed out of the Judiciary Committee a universal background check bill that we expect will pass out of the House at the end of the month. Climate change is a national emergency. The people that I represent who were victimized by Superstorm Sandy, a late October hurricane-like storm because of the changing climatic conditions, understand that dynamic. And so the president is going down, from a precedent standpoint, a very dangerous place, and that's why I think some of the conservatives may also object to what he is doing today.
Let me ask you about something else that you might consider a national emergency. Yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the Parkland school shooting, as you know, and I see your committee passed a new gun bill. Want to tell us about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So under current law, criminal background checks only apply to gun stores. But increasingly over time, that was the original Brady Bill that was passed in the 1990s, but over time an increasing amount of guns are sold at gun shows. These are temporary shows that travel from city to city, location to location, and no background checks are required. So anyone, even someone with a criminal record, can go to a gun show and legally purchase a gun without having to go through a three-day criminal background check. That makes no sense. Our legislation, H.R. 8, will close that loophole. In the era of the Internet, increasingly guns are being exchanged, bought, sold, traded on the Internet as well, and the current background check legislation does not cover Internet sales. And so H.R. 8, our legislation, will also require background checks. And the overwhelming majority of the American people, 95-plus percent, support the notion of universal criminal background checks. The reason why nothing has happened to date is because in a Republican-controlled House, they've been acting like they are working for the NRA as opposed to working for the American people. Those days are over.
We have time for one more call for you, and it's coming from Tracy in Southport, Connecticut. Tracy, you're on WNYC with Congressman Jeffries.
Hi, Congressman Jeffries. I agree with everything I've heard you say so far this morning. But I have a question that hasn't yet been addressed. Was there an FBI investigation into Kavanaugh and the woman who, Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who accused him of rape? Was it a complete investigation, and do you think there should be a complete investigation?
Thank you very much. And I think Congressman Nadler, the chairman of your committee, had said previously that if the Democrats take control, which you have, then there would be a new inquiry into Kavanaugh. Anything on the docket?
Congressman Nadler hasn't indicated that there is anything new, but that is the position that he previously articulated, and I think he articulated that position based on the notion that the House not only has oversight responsibilities over the Article II executive branch, we also have oversight responsibilities over the Article III judiciary, which of course includes the Supreme Court.
All right. Now we have a clip of President Trump declaring the state of emergency for the southern border, allowing him to move money around without the approval of Congress in the appropriations process. This is 40 seconds. Here he is.
So I'm going to be signing a national emergency, and it's been signed many times before. It's been signed by other presidents from 1977 or so. It gave the presidents the power. There's rarely been a problem. They sign it. Nobody cares. I guess they weren't very exciting, but nobody cares. They sign it for far less important things in some cases, in many cases. We're talking about an invasion of our country with drugs, with human traffickers, with all types of criminals and gangs.
So the president just moments ago, what do you want to react to from that, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries?
Well, this is a continuation of his xenophobic rhetoric, his hate-mongering, in order to rile up certain aspects of his base. It's quite unfortunate. We're going to see him in court. There are several factual misrepresentations that he made. The notion that this is an invasion. These are individuals who are fleeing some of the most violent countries in the world, the Central American Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. They're actually showing up at legal ports of entry, presenting themselves to Border Patrol agents to then claim asylum. The overwhelming majority of drugs don't come in through the southern border. They come in through legal ports of entry, through airports, as well as through waterways, which is why we should be enhancing the ability of the Coast Guard to interdict. So the factual underpinnings of the so-called national emergency are flawed and can be exposed just in that 40-second clip that you presented, Brian.
He cited the very high number of murders on the other side of the border at El Paso and the relatively low number in El Paso, Texas, as proof that walls work. Any reaction to that?
He actually is going negative on his own case, because the reality is, with respect to El Paso, crime was on the decline in the years prior to that border wall or fence or whatever he's calling it in El Paso. It's now one of the safest cities in the United States of America of its size. And when you talk to the mayor, when you talk to the former Congress member, Beto O'Rourke, a good friend, we were classmates who came in together into the House, it's clear that the safety of the city has nothing to do with whatever barrier exists, but the improved relationship between the police and the community working together to drive down crime.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from parts of South and Central Brooklyn and a little tiny wee bit of Queens, and he is now, as of this session of Congress, which just started last month, of course, he is officially the fifth-ranking Democrat in the House as the Democratic Caucus Chair. Congressman Jeffries, thanks for your report to your listeners. Let's keep talking.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate you always shouting out Howard Beach and Ozone Park as well.
Thank you very much.